welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. I know I go through this rather fast, but I say it every week. You can go to the podcast. You can get it again. RichardDugan.com is the location where you can get all the information. You can also listen to these via podcast, and I highly recommend that because many, many times we go longer than the 50 minutes allocated on the radio broadcast. As a matter of fact, I just completed a two-hour interview. So if you listened to that program, I'm not telling you which one, then you're going to need to go to the podcasts on SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Player FM, Blueberry, and many others as well. And if you see the little grocery cart in the upper right-hand corner of the SoundCloud podcast, you're going to want to click on that because that's going to take you to our guest's website where you can do more research and investigation. You can continue your evolutionary process. And by the way, if this is the first time you've listened to this program, go to the missions page and read what we're all about, as well as listen to this interview. And then if you like what we're doing, if it resonates with you and you'd like to support us financially, we have a PayPal and Patreon account. So please feel free to do that and support us in that way. Also, we are not nonprofit, so it is not tax deductible. Don't want to get in trouble with the IRS. Also, a reminder that my thanks go out to those people who have helped, who have supported us. My thanks go out to those who will support us. And I'm extremely grateful in that regard. Today's program I could have approached from a number of different perspectives, but I'm going to keep it a little more serious, if you will, because I think it's an important subject that we need to talk about, especially in light of what's going on in the United States, has been going on in the United States, most specifically in the last, I'm going to say, 5, maybe 10 years. Different states across the country have legalized marijuana for medical purposes. Great idea. There are many great benefits that can be derived. Especially, I've heard this, and of course, someone even suggested that I started using marijuana for the glaucoma that I had in my left eye. Well, that's null and void now. Be that as it may, then, of course, they moved on to for recreational use. And now we're seeing all kinds of just unbelievable problems that have arisen, not necessarily from the ingesting or the inhaling of the marijuana via the cigarette or what have you, but also the legislative, logistic, infrastructural problems. Here in Santa Barbara, for example, in Carpinteria, we have a problem with pot farms that are disseminating, the plants give off a pretty noxious aroma. Well, we're not actually talking about pot, but we're talking about hallucinogens. Pot is not one of those. Marijuana is not one of those. But we're going to get into all of that with our guest, who is with his wife, the co-author of Psychedelic Gospels, The Secret History of Hallucinogens in Christianity. And Dr. Jerry Brown, can I say doctor?
Yes, definitely not the governor.
Not the governor.
The ex-governor.
Not even related.
Not at all.
All right. Just happens to have the same name.
But an admirer.
But at the same time, I would venture that you probably would have made some better decisions under the influence of some of the things we're going to talk about, as far as getting insight into what's best for all of us, than some of our politicians do, the way that they do things.
Well, I really can't speak for politicians, but I can say that for my wife and myself, psychedelics have been seminal in our lives, especially in the 60s and 70s. And not beyond our wildest dreams when we, guided by friends and just children of the times, experimented with LSD and psilocybin and a few other substances, which became illegal under Nixon's war on drugs in 1970. Not in our wildest dreams could we imagine that today we'd sit here in the midst of a full-blown psychedelic renaissance in which these substances are being fast-tracked by the FDA for helping vets with post-traumatic stress disorder and people with terminal illnesses or serious illnesses to fight anxiety and depression, in fact, to fight anxiety itself. So to answer your question, yes, they've been very valuable in our lives, and also now because of the three-stage rigorous research protocols that these substances are going through, we believe one day in several years, we're going to see psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy facilities legalized in the United States. In fact, there's a group called Decriminalize California that's looking to put a an initiative on the ballot for 2020 to decriminalize psilocybin in this state, as it has been done in the city of Denver and also in Oakland now.
Psilocybin, normally commonly known as, is that LSD?
No, psilocybin is what's in magic mushrooms.
Magic mushrooms. Okay, so there's a difference there. Okay. Now, these substances, I don't want to say chemicals, these substances have been around as long as man has been here. They exist in nature, right?
Yes, absolutely. These plants, the fungi, I mean, fungi have been on Earth for 1.4 billion years. The fungal kingdom is far vaster than the plant kingdom. And in that, you have two very prominent psychedelics. You have the Amanita muscaria, the red and white dotted dramatic mushroom that you see in Scandinavian folk tales.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes on Christmas cards.
Okay.
And then you have psilocybin. There's about 200 varieties of psilocybin-type mushrooms around the world. It's very widely produced. Some people grow it at home because they've figured out how to grow it from the spores. And there's about 100 varieties that are active. We found evidence of both mushrooms in Christian art during the research we did in 2012. So you have both a historical use.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say, and no one can document how far back this goes, but the oldest evidence of mushroom use, magic mushroom use, is a beheaded mushroom-covered shaman that was painted on the walls in Algeria, 9,000 BC, so 11,000 years ago.
Wow.
And one of the ways to preserve these mushrooms is to put them in honey, is one of the ways to put them in,
honey
in nectar and honey.
Nature's unbelievable substance.
Sure.
It never goes bad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it can't get old. The worst thing that happens to it is it crystallizes. Well, that's easily solved.
Yeah.
You just heat it up a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's right back to its original state.
In a Jurassic Park
And it's
theme.
Great. Yeah, exactly. It's great for you. All of the different aspects of the beehive, for example, the propolis and the pollen and so forth, which are sold, are supposedly very good for the physical body, the
right.
biochemical aspects of it. But one of the things I want to tie in here for this program, because of the fact that it is more metaphysical and spiritual, and that is there's a story that I read in Autobiography of a Yogi that I've been reading. I've read hundreds of times. Started in when I was 17. It's my primer. And there's a story in there where there's one of his devotees is trying to see if, and I may be thinking of the wrong, I may be actually thinking of Ram Dass and an experience that he had where one of the devotees actually tried to slip into his tea or whatever he was consuming for that meal, LSD or some other hallucinogen. And there was absolutely no effect on the guru. And the individual who did this actually started to experience these things. And when that was all over, the guru actually sort of didn't confront him, but he approached him and said, "Hey, you know, you tried to slip something into my food there. And what you don't understand is I'm already there. I don't need these hallucinogens to get where everybody else is going to go when they use these." And so he is already at that higher level of consciousness. Is that the general, maybe it's the specific focus of your research, your study, and the reason why? Because it puts you in that altered state of consciousness that allows you to, say, I don't know, commune with the divine that maybe meditation doesn't do, get answers to questions that you have, to learn more about self. Because as I'm sure you've read in the ancient wisdom teachings, that's kind of the focus is to know thyself. And that's really where it begins with our education. If we don't know who we are, how are we going to know anything else for that matter? And that's the sort of the guiding light in much of metaphysics and much of the spiritual world around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the names that psychedelics have been given by contemporary researchers is entheogens. It means N within, Jen, Theo, mm-hmm. to generate, I'm sorry, N within, Theo, God, Dios, God, mm-hmm. and generate. Plants that generate the divine or God within. Mm-hmm. And these have done that historically. They were around through much of human shamanism, the religion widespread of all of our hunting and gathering forefathers. They're found at the roots of the major religions, and I could go into detail about that. Mm-hmm. And one of the characteristics of them is they can, not always, right. but at the right dose, under the right conditions, generate mystical experience. Yeah. These are obviously not the only ways to mystical experience. Mystics, mm-hmm. sages, sensory deprivation, meditation, certainly. This is one path. It's a very powerful path, and it's a fast-acting path.
Yeah.
And what's interesting here is that, well, what is a mystical experience? It's certainly something that's hard to describe in words. Mm-hmm. You feel a connection with the cosmos. It's out of body, out of time and space. It's not long-lasting unless you're an enlightened yogi and you are in the Satori 24 state right. of mind all of the time.
But that's like a lifetime of work
yes.
and devotion.
Yes.
And that's not the quick.
Yeah. And some people have I found this with people in the spiritual community, almost a sense of, well, that can't be, or almost a little bit of resentment of, yeah. I've meditated for 12 years, but this can induce a mystical experience yeah. quite quickly. And what is really interesting here is that, and I can give you an example of a mystical experience that I had that was very instrumental in my life, in fact, brought me to Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting here is that the researchers are finding the people at Johns Hopkins, at NYU, at UCLA, who are working with MDMA ecstasy for post-traumatic stress disorder for vets, first responders, trauma victims, and the people who are working with psilocybin, mm-hmm. to reduce anxiety and depression, which is a big issue worldwide. I mean, there's like 300 million people known to have depression worldwide, and there's no advances in treatment for the last 30 years. What they find in their research is that one or two sessions alleviate the depression, the anxiety, the trauma. One or two sessions in 70 to 80% of the people.
And it's long-lasting?
And it's long-lasting. Of course, it takes place not out on the street or in your bedroom. It
right.
takes place within the framework of a well-established psychedelic-assisted therapy protocol. Mm-hmm. Therapy, preparation, room, eye shades, music, a guide who facilitates that, and then integration of the experience.
I.e., a safe space.
A safe space yeah. With experienced guidance.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that the researchers report is the dramatic response of the results is directly proportional to the mystical experience.
Mm.
So what's happening here? Science is now able to predictably induce a mystical experience, which has been out of the range of science in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And this mystical experience is integral to the recovery. There's one other element that becomes very important. I think we all remember those Nancy Reagan ads, that, you know, just say no. And this is your mind. This is your mind on drugs. And this
yes.
Well, now we can see this is your mind and this is your mind on LSD, literally, because mm-hmm. Dr. Robin Carhart Harris at the Imperial College in London has been able to do magnetic resonance imaging, MRI,
yeah. uh-huh.
of normal people in a normal state of consciousness, and then after giving them LSD.
Mm-hmm.
And what you see is that the brain, only a portion of the brain is lit up in normal consciousness, and much of the brain is lit up under LSD.
Mm-hmm.
What happens here, and Carhart has developed theories about this, is that the brain normally operates in what's called the default mode network, sort of like your computer software.
Yeah.
It's in the default mode.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, if we bring in a lot of add-ons, mm-hmm. it can do other things. In the case of the brain, what happens is that the neural pathways, many other neural pathways open up. It's the difference between having a flashlight with a focused beam
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden the floodlights go on.
Mm.
And this allows people who have obsession, who've been trapped in very negative feedback loops that they can't get out of, who are sleepless, who are punishing themselves for all kinds.
It's just about everybody.
We're all human. We've all had parents.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Exactly.
And to expand and to see objectively their problem from a different perspective.
Yeah.
And that's where the healing takes place. Vets who cannot deal with the emotional impact of the trauma of what they've seen and what they've done and what might have been done, they can't go near it.
Yeah.
All right. But under MDMA, ecstasy, they can watch that and cathart it almost at a distance.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing happens with ayahuasca. In fact, I just received a call yesterday from an ex-Marine who'd been on two tours of duty, including Afghanistan, and he went into severe depression and was suicidal.
Mm.
Nothing helped him that the VA administration had. He said the vets call it Candyland because they just give you pills and opioids and antidepressants.
Yeah.
And finally, he went down to Iquitos, Peru, what he calls in the belly button of the Amazon, and started to experience ayahuasca. Yeah. And this helped him out of his depression, and now he's on a mission to help other vets. He told me a statistic that literally blew my mind. There are at least 20 veteran suicides a day in the United States.
Wow.
So, and the motto of the Marines is, you know, no man left behind.
Yeah.
And he says, look, I found a way out, and I want to help others because this is tragic. And for these heroes who served our country and who come back, and they can't be helped. And it's not that the Veteran Administration wouldn't like to. There's been no breakthroughs in this therapy in 30 years.
Yeah.
And now we have it. We have it with MDMA, and it's also available through ayahuasca.
Yeah.
So now what's happening is that these ancient pathways of shamanism and the roots of religion, and remember that these were integrated into shamanism because one of the things they helped with was healing.
Yeah.
And we're now using it for healing in our society today.
Well, first of all, to address the veterans issue, it's appalling to me that our government will ask these men and women to go off and put themselves in harm's way. And when they come back, they're abandoned by their own government. I realize we have the VA.
Right.
But for as long as I can remember, as a matter of fact, I did a little research on the care and feeding of the veterans who have come back from the various military conflicts, in a sense, and including the Revolutionary War. And this governmental mistreatment or maltreatment or non-treatment of veterans, it's been going on since the Revolutionary War. And that's what's really appalling to me, where the citizens then have to pick up and so forth. The other part of it is the lost potential of 20 a day, men and women, who take their own lives because they can't handle what they experienced. And what could they have contributed to our society and our civilization to help us to grow and be a better civilization? There. First of all, I remember seeing and actually interviewing the producer of a documentary called Welcome. The gist of it was a program for vets, Vietnam vets in particular, but all vets, who are dealing with PTSD and so forth. And in the conversation, the producer said that this program is not about sharing these stories of the vets and what they've been through and trying to help them and get their minds straight, so to speak, or you know, fix them. This documentary, he said, is about getting the civilian population to shift their perspective on the vets. That being said, on ayahuasca, I was introduced to it as a hallucinogen, as a psychedelic, if you will, through a documentary. I think it was called DMS, I think was the name of it. And I have never been approached by anybody from the time I, you know, was from birth to this moment. I've never been approached by anybody asking me to take any kind of psychedelics. But when I was in school, grade school and high school, I knew that other kids were doing stuff. Maybe it was just marijuana. It never interested me. Now, I've tried marijuana twice in my 30s, and both times I would have probably rather have had a beer, would have been just as effective for me. But I've never had any interest in doing these kinds of things. It just, it wasn't that, oh no, Nancy says say no, and it's bad, and it's wrong, and it could hurt me, and not. I just, there was no interest. After seeing that DVD about ayahuasca, that is the only substance that I would want to try to experience again under these safe and controlled environment to see what happens because of some of the experiences that some of these people had.
Yeah.
Now let me ask you a question. There are going to be those who are sitting there going, "Well, you know, that's great. You know, it's psychedelics to get to the divine and da 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 da." But I think I'd rather do it more organically. This is organic. These substances, they are organic because they are. This isn't something
God's creations. Plants.
For example, ayahuasca. You don't take it into a lab and you mix it with other chemicals and like when you read on the back of a package that's in the grocery store of all the processed stuff and the stuff you can't pronounce.
It's not mixed with that. It's all organic.
Yeah.
It comes from the combination of two plants, Benisteriopsis caapi. It's called the visionary vine. Mm-hmm. And there's another plant that's involved to facilitate the uptake of it into the human body.
But it's sort of prepared kind of like tea. Like I said, it's not taken into a laboratory.
No, it's brewed.
It's brewed.
And
so that's natural.
It's natural.
Pick it, put it in, away you go.
Exactly.
Okay.
And the movie, I don't know the movie you saw. It might have been DMT,
DMT.
The psychic psychoactive ingredient.
Yes.
In ayahuasca.
That's it. Yes.
There's also another film out there that you or your viewers may want to see called From Shock to Awe. And it's about two veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, mm-hmm. who found ayahuasca and their journey into the jungles and of Peru. Now, the good news is ayahuasca is still illegal in the United States.
You say the good news?
The good news.
Okay.
Right? However, there are two branches of the Brazilian ayahuasca-using churches, mm-hmm. Santo Daime and União de Vegetal, Union of Vegetables, that can legally use it here in the United States.
Oh.
This is under the 1993 Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which also allowed the 300,000 Native Americans who used peyote, mm-hmm. in their religious rituals to use it. In other words, if there was a deep religious tradition, the Supreme Court has approved and allowed this.
Yeah.
So that's going on. There is a great underground in the United States and in Europe of ayahuasca practitioners who travel up from the Amazon, and also people travel down to the Amazon to partake in this. I can speak from personal experience with ayahuasca, and this is not from a long time ago, but I had lived in Santa Barbara and worked here for 5 years until 2018 when I moved to Europe with my wife. And I had directed a safe energy anti-nuclear program for the World Business Academy, which is headquartered here in Santa Barbara, mm-hmm. with the goal of closing the nuclear plants in California. We were successful working with other groups with San Onofre and Diablo Canyon, which sits on multiple earthquake faults, will not be renewed. It's going to close in 2024, mm-hmm. at the latest. Mm-hmm. And I had worked in this area for 40 years of my life due to a vision I had on psilocybin back in 1979, which brought me into this path.
Yeah.
But my wife and I mean, I've been working for 60 years. I'm 76 now. I could not live after my work were done comfortably anywhere in California on a professor's pension.
Yeah.
So we moved to Europe. Mm-hmm. And this was going to be our time together. We were going to write. We were going to enjoy each other. Fortunately, we're the love of each other's lives. Mm-hmm. Good thing they kept saved the best one for last. You know.
Yeah.
And I get out on this trip, and I fall into a deep depression. I want to go home. I'm afraid I'm going to get old and die in a foreign country. Mm. I miss being Dr. Brown and all of the kudos that came along with this role, and I had real expertise there. And I'm driving my wife crazy. I get obsessed. I can't sleep at night. I went into, Richard, a severe depression. It lasted for 6 months.
Oh, wow.
I lost over 22 pounds, and I love to sleep. I couldn't sleep. I dreaded dusk. I would lay there with this obsessive thoughts running in my mind. Everybody tried to help me. You know, try Dr. Joe's meditation. Try this meditation. Mm-hmm. Follow Deepak Chopra, Tony Robbins. Mm-hmm. Do EMDR. Do tapping. Do this. Meditate.
Yeah.
And I tried all of these things. It was like shooting a water pistol at a nuclear aircraft battle carrier.
Yeah.
It had no effect.
Yeah.
Where we moved in Europe, it turns out there's a retreat center for yoga retreat and other retreats 15 minutes from us, and they bring ayahuasca shaman and leaders there twice a year. I went, I did an ayahuasca ceremony with a group of people, with a leader and three assistants. After I took the ayahuasca, I lay down and I started to visualize and to hallucinate. The first thing I saw was that I was a prisoner of my ego. And my ego, I saw it as cages, like as bars.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't be happy. I'm retired. I'm with my wife, the love of my life. I'm in Europe. I'm able to do anything I want to do. And I'm miserable.
Yeah.
I couldn't be happy. The prison of my ego, the bar shattered and fell on the ground. The next thing, when I was so obsessed, I couldn't think of anyone else but myself. How can I meet my needs? How can I get back to where I felt good about myself? And I saw, I visualized, and I felt what I was doing to my beloved wife. I was making her miserable in what was supposed to be the time of my life. And now I took that in. Mm-hmm. And then the last thing, I felt possessed because I have good brain chemistry. I've been happy and, you know, fortunate mm-hmm. most of my life, and I work things through. But I'm always happy to be alive, and I wake up singing in the morning. Yeah. I wasn't singing anymore. And I felt the possession was in the form of a black snake that was in me. I grabbed it, and I'm hallucinating.
Mm-hmm.
And I pulled it and struggled to pull it out of me,
mm-hmm.
and I flung it away on the floor, and it slithered away. This lasted till 4 o'clock in the morning. I went home, I went to sleep, and as my wife says, I woke up the next day, I was singing again, I was back, and I've never gone into the depression again.
Wow.
And this is one session.
Yeah.
People say about ayahuasca that it doesn't give you what you want, it gives you what you need. I did a week long of what they call the dieta, the diet, to
mm-hmm.
prepare, no sex, no salt, no alcohol, no meat. Which kind of cleanses you and lets you absorb the visionary vine more mm-hmm. effectively. So this is one of the things that's been helping people, and I think eventually it will also be researched and scheduled. But right now, it's MDMA, ecstasy, which people know, which in a controlled environment has really helped people recover from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah. Well, the thing that is so fascinating to me about this is that there are people who have experiences even without hallucinogens that they are then challenged. I worked for 15 years in a Christian radio station, and I would hear different experiences from people. Oh, I saw this, and I heard that, and da-da-da-da. And I sat there, and I took that in, and I'm going, who am I to challenge your experience? It was your experience. I'm not going to tell you that, oh, I'm sorry, it doesn't say anywhere in the book that you can have that experience. So, no, you didn't have that experience. That was the devil. And it's like, how can you do that to another human being to take away something that actually probably was helping them?
Right.
And so when you start to experience what, especially what you experienced, that actually turned you back, so to speak, into the person you were prior to the depression, or maybe it took you forward into the new person without the depression. It's like, why is that? It seems to me that there's something wrong in our culture here in the United States. I'm curious, you're living in Europe, what is the attitude both philosophically but also legally in regards to not hallucinogens in general, but ayahuasca in particular?
Right. Let me back up a little bit.
Sure.
First of all, and there's something that very few people realize, but when Nixon called Timothy Leary the most dangerous man in America in 1970
mm-hmm.
and passed the Controlled Substance Act, which made all of these psychedelics
yeah.
Scheduled One, no redeeming human medical value, and allowed people to be in prison for this. Many years later, and I have to look up which of Nixon's Watergate henchmen, was it Ehrlichman or Haldeman,
yeah.
said before they died, look, we knew these substances were not toxic. We knew they were not dangerous. We had a political problem. The political problem was we had an anti-war movement and we had a civil rights movement. And you could not make it illegal to be black, and you could not make it illegal to protest. So by making all of these and doubling down on marijuana, we were able to go in and arrest many of the leaders and many of the activists in the civil rights movement. These substances are still banned today, but because of the research that's going on, and look, the VA is at its wit's end. I mean, what's been done over history to vets is one of the greatest forms of hypocrisy, to praise these men as heroes when we send them off and treat them as vagrants when they come back. But to its credit, and the times are a-changing, as the man sang, the VA is looking for tools to help, and the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, has fast-tracked the research on these substances as breakthrough therapies because they don't have anything else available that's really working. Yeah. So we have a new day here in the psychedelic renaissance. In terms of the attitudes in the United States, what we've seen with medical with marijuana, we have 33 states that have medical marijuana legalized, and we have 10 states that have recreational marijuana legalized. What we've seen is that legalization follows medicalization. When people read these stories of kids who had tremors and were cured by marijuana, or see people who are helped by depression, it starts to shift their attitudes towards the substances. And this is why Denver voters on May 7th voted to decriminalize psilocybin. Oakland followed in June. It decriminalized all psychoactive plants and mushrooms.
Yeah.
Berkeley is considering that now, and there's an initiative in Oregon and California, Oregon for psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy, California, to completely decriminalize psilocybin. And the organization that's doing that is decrimca.org. And they need to get about 750,000 signatures to put that on the ballot. And they're doing a statewide initiative in every 57 counties to achieve that. So this, and because of, one, the research, two, because of Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, Michael Pollan, The Omnivore's Dilemma, a best-selling New York Times author, wrote exquisitely about his own psychedelic experience. He tried three psychedelic plants, and also gave an excellent summary of what's happening in the psychedelic renaissance. Given who he is, Michael Pollan was on all the major talk shows, in the New York Times review of books, op-eds, and all of this is starting to change the opinion in the media and among policymakers. So I think we are in the middle of what will be a shift towards eventual legalization, certainly for medical therapeutic issues. In Europe, Netherlands, these mushrooms are legal. And in Portugal, where we've moved, Portugal is unique. It is the first country in the world to decriminalize all drugs in 2001. They had a severe drug problem. They had soldiers returning from Angola and Mozambique, etc. And they had a raging drug problem, but they took a different approach. They said, we're not going to treat this as a criminal issue, as most countries in the world do, and as the U.S. is pushing through its international war on drugs. We're going to decriminalize everything. We're going to treat it as a medical problem. And if you're addicted, we're going to send you to therapy instead of jail. What's happened is that HIV contracted through dirty needles has dropped. Arrests have dropped. You can. It's illegal to sell, but it's not illegal to possess a 10-day supply of anything. If you're caught, you go before a lawyer, a doctor, and a social worker, and they recommend a treatment protocol. Drug overdoses have dropped. It's the second lowest in Europe. And really what's interesting here is that drug use has dropped 25%. Among the youth. So the hysteria that if you legalize or decriminalize these substances, everybody's going to go wild, it didn't happen. Yeah. It's no longer taboo.
Yeah.
And Portugal can serve as a model because the war on drugs has cost, you know, hundreds of millions, has incarcerated your neighbor's kids under mandatory sentences, ruined their lives, made them felons, made them unable to vote, given them a criminal record, difficult if not impossible to get a good job. And we have 2.2 million people incarcerated in this country, the highest percentage rate in the world, higher than communist China.
Yeah.
It is the land of the free, the home of the brave.
Yeah.
So about half those people are there for possession. These are victimless crimes. these are not the bad guys who should be locked up.
Right.
So we can unlock America, not pay for these people to stay in prison, have them become contributing citizens, and also help people through the therapeutic uses of these plants that God put here on the earth.
A couple things here that I'd like to touch on. First of all, from my limited knowledge and understanding of drug usage in our culture, and I speak now from the standpoint of from sea to shining sea and all citizens in regards to this, that usually it was understood that most people are taking, and this like goes back maybe to the 60s and 70s, that a lot of people, they were taking all these different drugs to escape the realities of quote-unquote the real world. Who knows what really the real world is? But that's what I was told, and that's what I learned, that, oh, they're just trying, they just want to escape. They want to get away from the man and the machine and all these kinds of things and the craziness and have a really nice trip, and, you know, and the only downside is that when, you know, if you're going on vacation, you leave, but then you end up having to come back. With the vets, it's along the same lines. They want to escape what's going on in their minds, their memories, and so forth. So they take these drugs, and okay, that was great, so I'm going to take more and more and more. And eventually, many of them, they overdose. They kill themselves, not necessarily intentionally, but just by virtue of saying, I can't handle what I experienced, so this is, I'm just going to keep consuming this stuff so that I don't ever have to think about it. It never comes back into my head. And so I'm wondering, is that part of why Portugal in particular, because that's the example you've given, has been able to achieve, as you've stated, the results they have? Because it's not that they've made Portugal, you know, a paradise, mind you, but that they have started looking at their citizens in a different light in terms of let's take care of our people. Let's be more concerned about the human being than we are about the rules and regulations and what other countries like the United States. The United States, by the way, as I've observed from within the walls, as it were, never wants to learn from anybody else. They are so, this country is so independent that even if every other nation on the planet were to say, yes, this is the solution to this problem, and the United States has it bad, say, the United States would say, nope, we'll find our own way. And if they were to take the solution that was offered to them by every other nation on the planet, overnight, it would solve the problem. But this country refuses to do that. We refuse to learn from other people outside of this country most of the time, especially on the governmental and institutional level. Is that kind of your experience of from the standpoint of, again, Portugal? These are our people. We need to take care of them. We don't need to incarcerate. We need to treat them so that they can then come back into the fold and be part of our family, our community of Portuguese.
Yeah, I think it's a very humane society that puts people first. I mean, I was surprised living there, and other expats have had the similar experience, where the one medicine I take is thyroid medicine. Mm-hmm. My thyroid medicine costs 1/8 of what it costs here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I go to a doctor, it's $15.
Yeah.
I heard someone had an appendicitis operation, 4 days in the hospital, $400. This vet I talked to said he had appendicitis. It cost him $35,000 for his hospital stay. And I don't know if there were complications involved.
Yeah.
But it's really putting people first and reconceptualizing the problem. I mean, we're seeing this with so many areas. We're seeing this with energy, where we have to move off of fossil fuels. We have to reconceptualize the problem. We're seeing this in economics, where we're very good at creating wealth in this country, and we're very good at innovation, but we're not good at reducing income inequality.
Yeah.
So we have to learn how to do that differently if we're not going to have a society that's going to be susceptible to racism and putting people against each other.
Well, I put that out there all the time as far as the economics. I says, who says this is the only economic model that we can work with?
Sure.
Who says?
Yeah. And we don't want to take away the incentive to do things, but you know, why does an employer have to earn, you know, 3,000 times more what an employee does or a CEO?
Because how did that employer even acquire that 3,000 times bonus?
Exactly.
Off of, if you will, off the backs of the employees.
Yeah. And that's why the World Business Academy, where I'm a fellow of the World Business Academy for many years, has teamed up with other corporations to create something called Just Capital, J-U-S-T, Capital, which rates the 1,000 companies in the United States as to how just they are.
Mm-hmm.
And it polls 85,000 Americans to see what is a just company. And paying an adequate wage of $15 an hour is one of the key things that people should have a living. People who work, many of the working poor, many of the poor are people who are working but can't make it on a minimum wage in a place like San Francisco, Santa Barbara, or Los Angeles. Yeah. So we have to have a balance between the incredible economic innovation driver that the United States is and taking care of our people. And the middle class has certainly suffered tremendously since the 1970s. So yes, we have to shift our thinking about that in many, many areas. Yeah. And certainly we're seeing that with moving towards what Portugal and other places have said is a responsible and a reasonable and an informed drug policy. And the thing you asked also, look, there are many people who should not venture into hallucinogens. If you're young, if you're fragile, if you're emotionally unstable, if you're traumatized, you shouldn't play with these. These are very powerful substances without the right context and without the right guidance.
I like the word you used. They are powerful. You didn't say dangerous, deadly, or any of those negative terms. You said powerful because of what they can bring you. And again, in those situations, whereas if you're just taking this stuff on the street, it is so powerful, it could kill you.
I don't think it can kill you.
No?
No. I mean, it could drive people to think they can fly and jump off of buildings.
Okay, yeah.
I mean,
we've heard that before.
We've heard that. And that's happened in some cases. Or people who just get so frightened because they are fragile. And these things, it's the railroad to the unconscious.
Right.
It can bring up the stuff you've buried away and didn't want to look at for years and years and years, family secrets, etc. And you may need help dealing with that and integrating. In fact, that's why the California Institute of Integral Studies has created a certificate program for people who are going to guide. These are our medical professionals and psychological professionals who are going to get trained and certified in how to guide people when psychedelic-assisted therapy becomes legal. But the other side of it, look, Lily Tomlin made a joke one time. She said, reality is a crutch for people who can't handle drugs. And but basically, many people who've taken psychedelics that I've known, they've found answers to who they were, what their soul's purpose is. That certainly happened for me and for my wife, Julie. They've gotten insights into the nature of the world. They've had, as I had, my first authentic experience of the divine in my life, which I never got through my own religious upbringing, and many people did not. And also, I got relief from depression from this.
Yeah.
So these are really helpful substances and can be, and for people searching for answers. In the United States, the Pew Research Institute does a poll, and one of the polls they do is religious. And one of the things they find is that 20% of Americans say, I'm spiritual, but not religious. I'm searching.
Yeah.
And 33% of the youth. And some people will explore psychedelics as a way to find those particular answers or insights. It's not for everyone.
Yeah.
It's not the only path, but it certainly is a verifiable path. These are not toxic substances. You can't overdose on them like you can on heroin or cocaine or other
And
opiates.
They don't stay in the body for an extended period of time like lead.
No. This is not strontium-90,
stay
you know,
in your liver.
Nuclear radiation, which is going to stay in your body, strontium-90, longer than you live, or mercury or lead or other things that the body cannot process out
with,
that can cause toxins and cause cancers.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking with Dr. Jerry Brown. He's an author, anthropologist. He's an activist. And we're talking about, we're going to actually dive back into, or more seriously into, the whole aspect of the psychedelic gospel. And we encourage you to stay with us. It's the secret history of hallucinogens in Christianity. We're going to talk about that as well here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay tuned. And welcome back. I'm Richard Dugan, along with Dr. Jerry Brown. He is an author, anthropologist. As I mentioned earlier, he's an activist as well, and we've talked a little bit about that. He's the co-author of, along with his wife, of the book, The Psychedelic Gospels, The Secret History of Hallucinogens in Christianity. Let's talk a little bit about that, and I'll do my best to stay focused on Christianity rather than drift off into some of the other religions. As you said, hallucinogens are part of pretty much all of the major religions. But this particular work, I'm curious as to why, and you can go ahead and shift that a little. There you go. Why did you focus specifically on Christianity as opposed to maybe the more newsworthy religion, say the Muslim religion? Why Christianity specifically?
Sure. Just a little bit of a backstory. So after my first LSD trip, high in the mountains of Colorado at a Rainbow Family, kind of a early hippie gathering in 1973, I had a frightening experience. Like Albert Hoffman, the discoverer of LSD, these are, as I said, powerful substances. And when I came out of that experience, I wanted to learn more, much more, about psychedelics. So being an anthropology professor at Florida International University, where I started teaching in 1972, I designed and taught a course on psychedelics and culture. It was called Hallucinogens and Culture, and it's still taught today. In the process, I learned a lot about psychedelics, a lot about entheogenic plants, ethnobotany, what the plants look like, how to identify them, theology, art history. Let's fast forward a long time to 2006. Julie and I are on our 20th anniversary trip in Scotland. And drawn by The Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown's bestseller, which saw mentioned Rosalind Chapel as a possible resting place of the Holy Grail, we went to Rosalind Chapel, which is a Catholic church, but it is a fusion of Catholic and pagan sculpture and architect. And it's probably unique in Christendom in this respect. One of the things they have are these green man heads, which are fertility heads from ancient times. They're found around the world, especially in Europe and India. And they have vines growing out of their eyes and out of their mouths. And the most prominent one came down over the altar where prayer and mass is said. And I bought a plaster replica of this green man head of Rosalind Chapel. 2 weeks later, Julie and I are sitting in St. Andrews, where the great golf started.
Oh, yeah.
And we're in an Italian restaurant, and I have this green man head on the table. And I turn it around, and I am looking at a replica of an Amanita muscaria psychoactive mushroom, the red and white ones you see in Scandinavian folktales.
Oh, yeah.
And now, and Julie found another reference in the church from Ezra 2 in the Bible, about which was an authentic psychedelic experience that Ezra had in the Bible. It's written in the Apocrypha to the Bible. So now our minds started racing. We're thinking, why did Sir William St. Clair, who constructed and designed Rosalind in the 15th century, put a psychedelic mushroom into the church?
Well, I mean, the red and the white, it's just pretty.
It's are they in other churches? Is there something in Christian ritual? Does Christianity have a psychedelic history? Could it go all the way back to the origins of Christianity when Jesus said, "Eat of my flesh, drink of my blood"? Was he asking people to partake in cannibalism, which both Jews and Romans alike would have found anathema? Probably not. What was the original Eucharist?
Yeah.
Now, we had to slow down because we were, if we were going to study this and find it, this would be an extraordinary claim. Yes, Christianity has a psychedelic history. And Carl Sagan, the great astrophysicist, said, look, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And we had evidence documented of one instance. And we wrestled with this for 6 years because it was a big undertaking and it was going to be a very controversial theory if we could prove it.
Yeah.
And finally, in 2012, we went on sabbatical and traveled through Europe and the Middle East. We went to England, to Germany, to France, to Italy, to Turkey, to Greece. And we went into churches and chapels and cathedrals, and we found evidence that we documented and duly photographed for our book.
Yeah.
And they're there in color plates in the book.
I saw that.
Of psychedelic mushrooms, both Amanita muscaria and psilocybin, in stained glass windows, in chart, in illuminated Bibles with many paintings in them, in sculpture, in frescoes, wall paintings, in ceiling paintings, in bronze windows and doors. We started out and we found examples of this in the center of France. We came to one place at the Church of St. Martin de Vic in the center of France, and we saw a veritable Christology, a life of Christ, accompanied by magic mushrooms from his entry to Jerusalem to the towers of Jerusalem to the very Last Supper, where there's psilocybin mushrooms on the table. And the artist even put mushroom caps into the hems of the disciples in the Last Supper. And that's where we had our aha moment. We said, this is an alternative history of Christianity. And Pope Gregory said in the 6th century, let art be the Bible of the illiterate. And most people in the Middle Ages, and we're talking, you know, 1,000, 10,000, we're talking about 1,100s, 1,200s, Middle Ages. And we found these examples all the way back to the 3rd century.
Mm-hmm.
There is no Christian art before 200.
Okay.
Poverty, persecution, etc.
Right.
And
I was just going to ask, just because those images are in the art, does that imply, is it implicit, is it direct, that they were using just because it's in the art? That's the other connection.
Sure. And what is it doing in the art? These are there for the initiates.
Mm-hmm.
This was not suppressed until the time of the Inquisition and the witchcraft trials and the Black Plague, mm-hmm. which I can get to in a minute.
Sure.
But this was present, and it's in the high holy places of Christendom, in Canterbury Cathedral, in Chartres Cathedral, in St. Michael's Church in Hildesheim. In many of these cases, we don't know. Was it the patrons of the church, the royalty? Was it the pagan royalty? Was it the Christian royalty? Was it the priest? Was it the artists themselves or a combination that put this into the artwork? But it is so pervasive that it wasn't suppressed, as some people have argued in Christianity. It was right there, and it was for the initiates. It was more in secret,
mm-hmm.
and hidden, and it's hidden in plain sight.
In plain sight,
Julie,
yeah.
And I asked, why didn't anyone discover this in Roslyn for 500 years? I mean, it's right there, hidden in plain sight.
Yeah.
Because art historians have no training in mycology, the study of mushrooms, or in ethnomycology. Neither do theologians, neither do tour guides. So Pascal said, chance favors the prepared mind. Fortunately, our minds, because of my Julie's psychedelic experience and my being a teacher of psychedelics and culture, were prepared and could recognize this. I took the Green Man head to Paul Stamets, one of the most eminent mycologists in the world. He's got a book called Mycelium Running, How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World. They can eat up toxins. They can heal cancer. I mean, it's an incredible book, Mycelium Running. And I asked him, is this an Amanita muscaria mushroom? He said, yes, it's a taxonomically correct Amanita muscaria. So we have one illuminated photo image that was painted in the Great Canterbury Psalter, which is a prayer book that was created in Canterbury Cathedral in the 1100s. And it shows Jesus healing the leper. And Jesus is standing tiptoe on a psychedelic mushroom. And we have to remember, a lot of people said, well, I search for God with psychedelics. But shamanism used psychedelics primarily for healing.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus was a healer.
Yes.
And this is a direct implication. Now, we don't have any smoking gun evidence from the time of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
We have parables. We have things that, if you look at it through the psychedelic gospel eyes, can be interpreted. But we are absolutely confident that there are psychedelic mushrooms in Christian art, that it wasn't suppressed, that it was done in secret for the initiatives. And I want to make it clear that we didn't write this book to challenge anyone's faith in Christianity, but to open up the possibility of a mystery that existed in many of the world's religions that there was the use of sacred plants.
Yeah.
And we don't think that this schism is long-lasting between the church and what happened in the Inquisition. We quote Brother David Stendhal Rost, who is a Benedictine monk, who said, "I want to embrace all of God's creations, all, yes, all, because if I can experience God through a sunrise on a mountaintop, then why not through a mushroom prayerfully ingested?" There's a magazine, it's called the American Conservative. It's a Catholic, conservative Catholic magazine. When the editor read Michael Pollan's book, I mean, we have not had an official response from the Christian church. I'm sure we're not on their radar from this.
Not yet, anyway.
And it took them 300 years to forgive, you know, Galileo, to apologize to Galileo.
Yeah.
We hope this conversation will advance more quickly, and there are signs that it will. Because after reading Michael Pollan's wonderful book, How to Change Your Mind, which is his study of the psychedelic renaissance and his experiences with psychedelics, he said, you know, and he's writing to Christians. He says, I want to talk about psychedelics. No, don't run away. We're going to have a conversation. This is very important. Sit down. I've got a lot to say, and it's going to take a while. And he says, a number of points that should open a dialogue. One of them is, we now have documented scientific evidence that psychedelics can heal and help people who are suffering. And certainly we are as Catholics and Christians are about that, about alleviating suffering. Mm. So we shouldn't dismiss psychedelics, and we should be open to the medical and therapeutic value that they can bring. We also now have verified experimental evidence that psychedelics can predictably induce a mystical experience, which about 33% of the people who take them in controlled research settings say, this was the most powerful and significant experience of my life. And another 33%, this is one of the most significant experiences of my life.
Mm.
And if this is analogous to what Christian mystics and saints have been visualizing and experiencing through the ages, we shouldn't discount this. We should be open to that conversation. What is open in Julie and my mind to, you talk about new paradigms on on your show. We hope there will be in time. And this would have to be like the cathedral builders. You know, you lay the foundation for a cathedral and you're never going to see it completed.
Right.
But hopefully the seeds are being laid where not only Christianity, but Islam, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, just like the ayahuasca churches in Brazil, will become open and allow retreat centers where people can have a direct experience of the divine in a safe and facilitated environment. That's our hope for an entheogen reformation that will take place out of this psychedelic renaissance.
It's interesting, too, and I hadn't really thought about it before, but in this conversation, you bring it to mind. The only group that I know of, the only spiritual group, we could say religious group, that I know of that uses any kind of mind-altering substances are Native Americans. We hear about peyote all the time. I grew up in Arizona and Phoenix, and I heard different tribes, they're using this and that and the other, but peyote was always at the top of the list. And it never even occurred to me until now, well, wait a minute. If they're using these hallucinogens in their ceremonies, and again, that's where they're using them. It's not on the street somewhere. Then the next logical question is, since the Native Americans have been around a lot longer than especially Christianity, because I know they were around long before Christ in different ways, then how is it that the other faiths, if you will, other philosophies didn't use something along these lines? That Native Americans are the only ones?
No. What you're going to find is that many, many groups of shamanism, and this is a form of shamanism, of indigenous religion,
right,
from Africa to Australia to the Amazon to Mexico, use psychoactive plants in their religious practices.
Yeah.
If these people migrated out of Central Eurasia 14,000 to 40,000 years ago, and they came across the Bering Straits, and they looked for these substances in the New World.
Mm-hmm.
Peyote, which has the psychoactive 30 different alkaloids in it, of which the most prominent is mescaline. is the psychoactive. It's a very visual, very mind-expanding alkaloid.
Mm-hmm.
It's a cactus. It's very bitter to chew. I've chewed it. It's extremely bitter. The Huichol Indians and the Cora Indians, indigenous people of the escarpment of western Mexico, have gone on peyote hunts since time immemorial. They take their kids, breastfeeding mothers ingest the peyote, and they say, we take our children to show them, this is how it is to go Huichol. When a Huichol shaman someone told him, oh, peyote, it's a drug. He said, no, aspirin is a drug. This is sacred.
Mm, yeah.
And their religion is based on this. So what's interesting here is that after the collapse and the final defeat at Wounded Knee 1 of the American Indians, and they were restricted to reservations. They could no longer control the material world.
Yeah.
They turned inward. And this is where peyote spreads like wildfire out of Mexico, up through Texas, and into the Plains Indians as a rejuvenation, as a healing, as a path, the peyote path. And there are peyote roadmen who guide this. Because there was this long indigenous history, anthropologists testified before the Supreme Court many years ago to get peyote use legalized for the members of the Native American Church.
Yeah.
And then this was reaffirmed in 1993 under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which said if you've got an indigenous tradition, even though it's not one of the mainstream religions, you should have the right to practice this under the First Amendment to the Constitution, where we shall make no laws that inhibit
right.
free expression or the practice of mm-hmm. religion. This doesn't only apply to things like Santo Daime and UDV, which use ayahuasca DMT containing in the religious practices, and to the 300,000 plus members of the Native American Church. For example, Santeria in Miami, where I lived and taught, which is a shamanistic religion which believes there's God and goddesses. It comes out of Africa in the slave ships.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes Macumbe in Brazil, Curandismo in Dominican Republic, Santeria, and Voodoo in Haiti.
Yeah.
The right to have animal sacrifice in Santeria, which is part of their religion, mm-hmm. the right to openly practice Santeria was affirmed in 1993 mm-hmm. by the Supreme Court because the city of Hialeah in Miami tried to ban it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, one of the things that I came across in a documentary about it was not specifically about Wounded Knee, but it was actually about the Treaty of 1868. And in our modern times, the 21st century, there was a Supreme Court case where I can't remember all of the details. All I remember is that the Native American tribe, this particular tribe, was arguing a particular position, and the court sided with the Native American tribe because of the 1868 treaty. They said, because this treaty was never null and void, it's still active, it's still alive, We side with the plaintiff, the Native Americans, whatever the tribe was. And I'm sitting here thinking, I heard time and time again from 1868 to the present about just one, the reservations got smaller and smaller in violation of that treaty and on and on and on. And it's like, thank God they signed that treaty in 1868, because that is going to come back to haunt the government. And this is a side issue from my perspective. I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program. This has been fascinating, and we've only scratched the surface. I really would like to continue this at some later date when you come back, because I know you're on your way out of Santa Barbara.
We'll be back.
Continued travels. So when you come back, I would love to continue this conversation. I have three final questions for you, but I want to remind our listeners about the book. It's called The Psychedelic Gospels. It is the secret history of hallucinogens in Christianity. Dr. Jerry Brown, along with his wife, Julie Brown, put this book together, and we are very, I have to say, I am grateful, because it opens up, as you have already alluded to, a dialogue. And that's where we have to start. We have to start talking about these kinds of things and beginning to understand from the different perspectives. That's what this program is about. We have an event, Psychedelics in Christianity, and it's in the middle of the circle. And what we want to do is we want to walk around the circle and view it from all the different points to get a broader perspective and understanding about it, whatever the subject is, whether it's this or any other subject, so that we can know that, you know what, we have other choices. We can go in many different directions. And so that's what we want to do with this program. Before I let you go, a reminder that the website is psychedelicgospels.com. We will be linked to your website.
Perfect.
Okay? I have three final questions. And again, I thank you so much for giving us this time. First question is, who is Jerry Brown?
That's a final question.
One of three.
Jerry Brown is a father of two children who are very happy and successful in their lives. He's a very happily married man. He's an anthropologist by training. He's an activist by advocation and an educator. Secondly, what's the second question?
Second question is, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
Open up an informed and responsible dialogue around the topics of psychedelics and American society.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
My life's purpose at this point in my life, and we go through various changes now that our children are happily married and we've raised healthy and happy and productive children, is to research, educate, speak, and write about the benefits that psychedelics can bring to our society and to the globe.
Dr. Jerry Brown, along with Julie Brown, his wife, the Psychedelic Gospels, psychedelicgospels.com is the website. We encourage you to go there. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.